Ride, coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. And as I do this show today, the sky outside is a very odd orange, not as apocalyptic orange as it was a couple months ago, but the sun was a very, very, very bright orange. If you're a Star Wars fan, if you listen to this show, you're probably a Star Wars fan. It was the color of the sun that Luke sees when that iconic shot in Tatooine where he's thinking about leaving the goddamn farm and going on an adventure. Giggle you hear in the background is my guest for today. I'm pretty excited to talk to this person. I first discovered him on the Michael Brooks show as the quote unquote chief economist. Please welcome David Griscom.
How's it going? Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for this.
Thank you for coming on. I would see you on Twitter and you would comment about sports. And I think maybe it was even over a year ago. You had said something about, does anybody here like watch football? And it was kind of crickets. And I'm like, oh shit, I hella love football. Double oh shit, I love college football. So me and this dude have been going kind of back and forth about college football for a while now. My team, I have a team. I'd root for Stanford. My girl went to SC. She's a little bit of a Trojan fan, very little. But I treat college football like the Republicans treat the GOP, and I'm all about the Pac-12. It's Pac-12 first. If we have to sacrifice a team to get to the championship, so be it.
That's pretty good.
Mr. Grissom, what is your team?
I mean, my team is University of Texas Longhorns. Been a long time diehard fan. Probably too much of a fan. It's been a very difficult past decade for me. But you stick with it. You stick with it, you know?
One of the greatest games to this day that I've ever seen of any sport is the 2006 championship game, University of Texas against USC.
Absolutely. And that was like, you know, those were some great years after that, too. And, you know, it ended pretty unceremoniously, that beautiful Mac Brown era with, you know, Colt McCoy going out with the shoulder injury against Alabama. And then from then on, it was basically, you know, since around 2009, it just has been nightmare season after nightmare season. I have faith, though. I think, you know, with some hiccups that we've been seeing because of COVID, I think Texas is actually looking pretty good. And it might be a frustrating year for Texas to finally come back in a year where there's going to be a million excuses as why to discredit any kind of return for any team.
any sport this year, and that's all of them because we got locked down in like March, has an asterisk by the championship. Mm-hmm. LeBron's going to get an asterisk next to his.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I understand it. But I also have to say that there is something to be said of a group being able to push through an absolutely, you know, bizarre time in sports to win a championship, regardless of what happens, you know, surviving that and winning, I think is something that you can be proud of. I don't think it's like a cheap way to win if you do win.
I wouldn't say it's a cheap way to win because I have issues with just out of conference games in general. Mm-hmm. I will say it, you know, I am a Pac-12 homer, and I think they have, for the most part, a tougher out-of-conference schedule because they schedule more travel that's, like, out of time zone. Mm-hmm. And the SEC, the big beef I have with the SEC is they generally don't go out of time zone too much.
That's true. I mean, I think the whole system when it comes to out-of-conferences needs to be completely reimagined. Because it's bullshit that, I'm sorry, I don't know if we can.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Okay. you know,
this is hood talk.
Just making sure, you know, I mean, the Clemson plays like nobody for its like first three games of the season. Look, Clemson is good. I'm not taking anything away from them, but it's ridiculous that all these other schools basically have to risk themselves, or hell, even what Notre Dame has been able to do for the past few years, you know, which, like, don't get me wrong, Notre Dame like schedules a few important games in their season, but they don't have to sit in a conference when you never know who the sleeper team is going to be in your conference year in, mm-hmm, year out of college football. And that's why it's fun to watch. So, I mean, I absolutely agree that the whole system right now with out of conference games needs to be, you know, radically reimagined, or they just need to expand the playoffs. Because the reason they don't play out of conference games, most of these teams, is because they know you can't have a loss and make it to the playoffs.
Yep.
And that's bad for the fans. Like, I would rather watch games, you know, watch more interesting matchups, especially in the beginning of the season, without having that risk being like, oh, you take a risk early in the season and that means your whole season is ruined from then on out. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's anti-competitive for sure.
And a lot of it has to do with the bowl system, and I get that to a degree. But then if you think about it, the pro football level, we've had wild card teams that didn't do well during the season win Super Bowls.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And upset. I mean, the was it 2007 New York Giants beat the undefeated Patriots?
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember that far back right now, if I'm being honest.
And to me, to watch that in college football, because sometimes we see those teams that get on a roll at the end, it's like, man, a better matchup would have been this team versus this team. Like, oh, I much would have rather have seen SC versus Auburn opposed to Oregon, or, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No, I think so. I mean, like, that's my biggest argument. I mean, obviously, I'm not in no position to have any influence on the sports world, but I've been saying this year they really should expand the playoff system. It's the perfect year to do it. Hell, you know, do eight teams, maybe even more, because it's going to be ridiculous at the end of the year, you know, including with teams from like the Pac-12, mm-hmm, and the Big Ten. Because I think, like, you know, you got to see it both ways. It's like, you know, if some teams are playing six games, you know, there's an argument to be made that those teams are untested. But it's also like, if, you know, what can they do in that situation to prove themselves to you? And then at the same time, it's not going to be fair for teams to play essentially a full season and have one or two losses on their schedule, and get, you know, somebody from the Pac-12 or Big Ten selected over them. So I hope that they make that decision. Who knows? I mean, it seems like they might be open to it.
We'll see. I honestly got my feelings hurt when the Pac-12 decided to come back and play and the Big Ten decided to come back and play. I really was excited that they were going to sit out the season. I thought that was a hell of a moral move to be like, we're not all about the money. But boy, was I wrong.
Yeah. I mean, this is the one thing that's hard to, like, be a sports fan and, mm-hmm, kind of do in the political world that I'm in, is it's like, I mean, it's conflicted like anything in our society, from the, you know, the food we eat to, you know, everything that we're doing is touched by a pretty cruel system that ignores people's needs and safety. You know, my hope is that people, you know, they do their best to take care of folks, you know, as well as they can. But, you know, it seems like the trend in this country in general is that, you know, we're going to see more and more things being, you know, reopened. So my only hope at that point is that, you know, because we know that they failed, the government has failed completely.
Yes.
To take care of people, to actually make a continued quarantine, you know, like a safe and viable option. So, you know, this was going to happen, was that we were going to have to start taking risks to reopen. And my only hope is that these organizations do as much as they can to protect people. But, I mean, we're seeing there's pretty wide realities in college football, especially from like a University of Texas to some random school, you know, like Central Arkansas, right?
Yeah. You know, my prediction is, I think one of two things is going to happen. I don't know if you saw recently, an NFL game just got postponed.
Yeah, it was the Titans.
Titans, and I can't remember who they were playing, but just got postponed because of positive COVID tests. Mm-hmm. And we've seen college games get postponed because of positive COVID tests. Mm-hmm. If we saw the NBA was in the bubble, right? They called it the bubble that they were in. Mm-hmm. And you had players going out to the strip club. You think you're going to keep, and there was only 12 cats on the NBA team. Yeah. You think you can keep 90-plus college kids from not associating with one other kid, getting out to one party, especially in places like Texas that are open? Yeah. No, it's foolish to think that something's going to happen. And I think a lot of these kids know that, and their agents know that, and their parents know that. And I think we're going to see, and if I'm right, you gotta give me my props if I'm right on this, Mr. Griscom.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a kid that's going to have a standout day, and he's going to go, I'm done for the year. I'm going to the draft.
Oh, but because of COVID? Oh, you can basically just retire mid-season.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, honestly, if you start to see like a lot of games getting canceled, it starts to make more and more sense for those players. I mean, the flip side of this too is people who aren't really ready to go to the draft. They really do need time. The reality on their end is like, God, they have to be at school for another year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just add a whole extra year to, you know, to their lives and to their university experience, which, you know, I don't know, might be nice.
I was watching that, was it the A&M and LSU game?
Mm-hmm.
And the kid for A&M was actually at Stanford last year, KJ Costello. And he set a record. Because I was bouncing back and forth watching the Texas game.
Was he a Corona transfer? Was he a Corona transfer?
Yeah.
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 That's another thing, too, that sort of screws the Big Ten and the Pac-12 as well. So all those guys, like, left to go to the SEC or the Big 12.
And he lit that. He was okay at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out, he was like a supposed to be like the big arm guy. He was supposed to be the next Andrew Luck.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really work out that well for him for, you know, a plethora of reasons. But he threw for like 600 plus yards. And wow. It was the first ever time a national champion lost their first game the following year, defending their title at home, which doesn't mean anything right now.
Yeah. No, I hear you. It's been LSU, I mean, look, it's difficult for them because Burrow is obviously such a big part of that team. Nobody expected Mike Leach and, you know, at Mississippi State, though you should have put money on it to pull up the upset that he was able to pull together. But look, I mean, this is going to be a weird year. I'll tell you this, my like, you know, hot take on college football this year, it's barely a hot take. Mm-hmm. It's just an analysis. We're going to see a lot of bad football, but a lot of exciting games in the sense of, you know, number three teams getting picked off by unranked teams. Like, you're going to see a lot of that. And that makes it interesting, at least as a fan. I mean, I'm trying to remember the names of the teams. Like, Austin, the first college football game of the year, which I watched because I
was trash. It was trash.
No, it was.
I told you that on
awesome.
Twitter.
It was an awesome game.
It was University of Texas San Antonio against Texas State.
Oh, yeah, that game was terrible. I'm talking about Austin Peay versus Central Arkansas.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah,
you can go ahead and watch that. And this was like in August, and because it was the first game on television, and it was bad. I mean, like, their punter couldn't punt the ball, I think, for Austin Peay. So their coach just in the middle of the game said, okay, we're just going to do, you know, pooch kicks, you know, having the quarterback punt on fourth down. And that's what they did for the entire game because their center couldn't snap the ball. Right. So this was bad football, but it was so exciting because like every other possession was like an interception in the end zone, touchbacks, 17-24, you know, final, you know, 2 minute drive to win the game. It was all of the excitement of football without any of the skill.
Without any of the big names, I mean, yeah. You know, that reminds me of like watching a Hawaii game in like 1988.
Yeah.
On ESPN before they had like 15 ESPNs, it'd be like Hawaii against Fresno State at 9 o'clock at night. Five people in the stands. No, that's something that I kind of miss. Like I miss watching those games. And I do like the fact that you actually are a football fan and will comment on football on Twitter, kind of to just me and you, but sometimes other people do jump in.
Sometimes more and more people are jumping in. It's just like, you gotta stand up for it. You know, the problem with the left is like, they refuse to be normal people sometimes. And I'm not saying you have to like college football. look, there's a million reasons not to tune in. I get it. But you know what? Like, where I'm from, it's a big part of culture. It's something I grew up watching. It's something I enjoy. And I think that kind of standing on the sidelines and not participating in, you know, general culture because, you know, of our politics is a mistake. Not only in the sense of, you know, it makes it harder to recruit people, but it also just makes people sort of, you know, there's like a Spartan aesthetic to it that I just don't find mm-hmm. to be very attractive, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I don't enjoy things. So that's my whole thing. And I also like, I can't stand like whiny people who come into my mentions on Twitter to like
point people, fingers of shame well, point at you.
You know, it's not even about the politics of college football really, as much as it is like people saying things like calling it sports ball, which just like, ugh. Look, that doesn't annoy me because like it offends me. It annoys me because that's such a lame thing to say. Like, I don't think people realize how boring you sound.
And I don't think they realize how much of fans of football that Matt and Trey Parker are, or Matt Stone and Trey Parker are. They're like huge Bronco fans.
Is that true? Wow.
Yeah, that's why they may have all those like John Elway references in their show.
Oh damn, you're
they're on the NFL Network has a thing about the Broncos winning their first Super Bowl, and they're on it.
No, that's hilarious. Talking
about how excited they were when the Broncos won their first Super Bowl. So it is funny that people kind of think, oh, well, it's like those guys are huge fans and they wouldn't like you.
They'd be hell of annoyed.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, I get it. You don't like sport. I'm not going to fucking rub it down your throat. Just Emma, I've actually had a Twitter conversation and then it ended up blowing up. What's her name? Emma Vigeland. Am I saying it
yeah,
right?
Yeah, from TYT. Good friend.
She's a Giants fan, and huge. I remember when what's his name played his first preseason game last year. Mm-hmm. What's the quarterback's name? Daniel Johnson?
Daniel Jones, right?
Daniel Jones.
Yeah.
Me and her were going back and forth like, oh man, this guy might actually be legit. And I thought that was fun. So there is some out there.
We can bash like a huge Knicks fans. I mean, there's plenty.
Oh, no shit.
yeah. Like, there's plenty of fans out there. That's the other thing too. Is it's just like there's plenty of people out there. They just sort of, you know, don't talk about whatever. Like, who cares what people do on Twitter at the end of the day? But I just think, you know, it's good to be a little bit of a normie sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And that's how, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't say the word recruit, but I mean, that's how, if I'm trying to build up a strong move, which is what this show is all about, like, mm-hmm. right? I can't, if I sit here and try to egghead talk you, you're probably going to be like, yeah, fuck you. Mm-hmm. But if I make the conversation fun, like when you go to the barbershop, everybody's talking shit and we're having a good time and we throw some real life shit in there and you're like, oh, this is, oh, let me learn a little bit more about this. Let's have a, tell me more about this labor theory of value.
No, 100%. I mean, you know, again, this is a Twitter thing, but you know, my Twitter bio says, you know, honky tonk socialist, honky tonk Marxist. And, you know, I'm all about that too. Like, I'm a big country music fan.
I was going to ask you about that because the gentleman that does the graphics for the show had asked, he goes, is David Griscom a guitar player? I was like, I think so, because there's guitars on his thing.
I play guitar and I play banjo. I used to be really into playing music. I've been getting back into it a lot lately, as you can imagine. I mean, I've always loved playing music. I had a band in college, like everybody had a band, didn't do much with it. I love to play, acoustic guitar mainly, pick on the banjo. I keep on meaning to like get into the electric guitar, but it's confusing to me still. Like, I understand how to play it and strum it, you know, but like messing around with the effects and getting your sound right is still something I just don't have the brain for right now. I have to spend some time with it.
You know what? That is the eternal mission for us guitar players. the gentleman that does the graphics, he is driving from the Bay Area to Kansas.
Oh wow!
Driving to pick up a Sun guitar amplifier head and a 6-speaker cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, it's kind of not the tone that he usually plays with. But he told me, he's like, you know, I can't pass up this deal, and you know, it's a 1974 Sun, and I feel we were joking about like what pedal configuration were you going to use. Mm-hmm. It never ends. I have a room full of amplifiers as we speak.
See, and that's what I'm trying to avoid with the electric guitar, because I just don't know if I can afford that right now.
Yeah, that's another. Well, the benefit for me is like I live in this music space where mm-hmm. people get rid of shit.
Oh, that is nice.
And the shit that people have gotten rid of for me is like, oh, wow, you're going to get rid of that? Like, there's some big bands that come through. It's like, oh, Testament's getting rid of their old backline? Okay, great.
Oh, I'm sure. No, that's awesome.
So are you, is that what your band was? Was it a country band?
Yeah, it was like country folk, you know, just kind of simple songs. You know, I sort of learned how to play bluegrass growing up. And then, you know, obviously have a lot of love for, you know, classic country, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was a little bit of a kind of folksy, blues, you know, like bluegrass country band.
You knew a lot of covers playing in Austin?
Yeah, I knew a decent amount of covers, and I had an interesting group of people in my band. I probably was the most interested in the bluegrass and country music aspect of it, but I was definitely the driver. But, you know, the problem with the band was that we would have practice on I went to school in D.C. and at American University, and we didn't have class for the most part on Wednesday. So on Tuesday, you know, evenings, we'd have band practice from 5 to 6 and then like have some beers after, and then people would start showing up. And then we started throwing essentially like this big weekly rager. And eventually the party started to become more important to everybody than the practice, and it sort of started to fizzle out.
That sounds like rock and roll, my friend.
Yeah, exactly. But it was fun times, man. I miss it.
I know quite a few people that still live that. That still live that party.
Yeah, man.
It never stopped. So you go to you grew up in Austin. Mm-hmm. You go to school in DC. What prompts you to leave Texas, the land of a kajillion universities, and go all the way to DC?
Well, so I went to high school in South Carolina. You know, out of my control, my mom married somebody who she was with for a few years. They're separated now, but moved us to South Carolina, which, you know, I have fond memories and love for people I knew in high school. But South Carolina was not home for sure.
West Columbia or?
No, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Redneck Riviera.
Okay. Yeah, hella.
Which is a hilarious place. It's just a hilarious place in my life, which is why I don't talk about it too much. Yeah, you know, so I went to high school there, you know, played soccer, all that kind of stuff. And I knew I wanted to get out of South Carolina. I really wanted to go to the University of Texas, but I went to a very bad high school. And my high school guidance counselor failed to send in my application to the University of Texas at Austin. So I didn't even get the opportunity to apply. Yeah, I was very upset about that. But I applied to a few schools, and I got, you know, I was interested in politics, so I got accepted at the school in Washington, D.C. at American University, which for people who don't know is basically where the like technocrats and bureaucrats and pencil pushers of the American like state all go to school. And it was a very weird place for me to go to because I went there with, you know, some left inclination, but definitely a bit of a kind of hippie vibe. And, you know, went to like a suit, you know, a suit and tie area.
Did not fit in D.C.
No, definitely not. And the
especially
fact
where
that,
you were, yeah.
And the fact that I was like a Southerner and I wasn't like an apologetic one at that, mm-hmm. you know, where some people, they want you to like, oh, I'm from Texas or South Carolina. And like a lot of liberals want you to like, they have a pause after you say that for you to apologize or attack everyone in your family. And I, you know, and I don't do that, right? I don't have that kind of shame. So, you know, anyways, I go there, but then I went to school, right when Occupy started.
Okay. So, it's like 2010 or so.
Yeah. 2011. So I started going to Occupy pretty much my whole freshman, first semester was at Occupy. And, you know, that did its job for me. I got radicalized pretty quickly, became a socialist, mm-hmm. specifically a Marxist, sort of dealt with some of the failings I found like in practice with like anarchist philosophy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from then on out, spent the next few years at school studying, you know, political theory and philosophy, a lot of Marx. I was very lucky because I had no idea what I wanted to do when I went to school. And American University, you know, it's like a liberal school, but it's a kind of like, you know, capitalist, you know, reactionary institution, but the philosophy department, for whatever reason, was just incredibly radical. So I had, you know, and I didn't go there initially to study philosophy, but that's what I ended up studying. And I was able to be taught by some really wonderful, wonderful people. You know, shout out specifically to Dr. Irfani, who is an incredible, you know, he was an incredible philosopher and a teacher of like post-colonial philosophy and Marxism. So, you know, this kind of like redneck kid ended up getting a pretty worldly education and, you know, pretty radical one at that. And, you know, and, for, you know, from then on out, I was just trying to find ways to do, you know, to bring my ideas into my life and to start to practice the politics and the ideas that I had.
Is that what brought you to New York?
Yeah. I mean, quick version of the bio is that, like, you know, I wanted to do media. So I was trying to write for a little while. I worked for Arabic English publication, but it's primarily in Arabic called Al Arabiya. So I did that for about 6 months during my senior year of university. And then I got a job at a group called the Atlas Project, which is basically like a Democratic Party think tank that did like state level analysis and state level politics. So, you know, if you're running a state campaign in Wisconsin, they'll give you like a huge rundown on like the dynamics of the state. I hated that job. it was horrible. I mean, that was the closest I ever had to like an establishment style job, and they weren't paying me nothing to do it.
Of course.
And they basically, it was actually horrible. They had a bunch of high paid executives who just like were able to hang out for the most part. And then they locked a bunch of kids, you know, right out of school in a room with no windows where they did all of like the actual work, you know, for essentially no payment. I was still bartending the whole way through that. But yeah, so I did that, quit that. And then I worked for another organization called Taxpayers Against Fraud, which was a nice job. They basically worked to prevent healthcare fraud, all these horrible hospitals and pharmaceutical companies that scam the government. But I enjoyed that. But once Donald Trump got elected, we worked really closely with the government, and we were supposed to have a meeting with Jeff Sessions. And I was just like, I don't know if I can do this. So,
and not call him out.
So I left that job, which was, I don't know, sometimes, and I left that job and I moved up to New York because it seemed like that was where a lot of socialist activity was going. I never in a million years would I have thought I'd be in Brooklyn. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. But it's been a really, you know, wonderful time. I got to meet, you know, one of my, a very important person in my life, my friend and comrade, Michael Brooks. I met him through one of my university professors, Luke Mayville, who's a wonderful person who's doing great work in Idaho right now. Yeah, but I met Michael, and there was no promise or anything. I'd written a few pieces in Counterpunch here and there, different publications. But I, you know, met Michael basically to, you know, get a lay of the land and to, you know, get an understanding of, you know, how to get a start up here. And we just started making fun of Sam Harris.
So last year, last fall, my band Bitter Lake was on tour, and we were in New York, and we were supposed to play Brooklyn.
Oh, nice.
And we were going to have, I think, a day off before we had to go to Montreal. So I was going to take that day off and try to go on your guys' show. And I had hit up Michael Brooks on, I can't remember what medium I hit him up on, because I'm a patron, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And he hit, he was like, dude, hit me on this Discord and let me know where you're going to be in town, and we'll hook it up for you to get down here. And we were all stoked. The band were like, oh, we're going to take the day off and we'll go to Brooklyn, and you know, let's go hang out at this dude's show. He's hella funny, and we'll kick it with this cat. And
yeah.
So I was all stoked to like meet you guys, because I've also lived a year in North Dakota.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. So you'd have something to talk to Matt about.
Yeah, I wanted to know what city he was from in North Dakota, because I worked out there for a year.
Yeah, I think he's from, I can't remember the town, it's near Fargo.
I mean, there's a lot of nothing. It's like you get in, you leave Montana and Billings, and you see nothing, and then you see Fargo.
Yeah.
And then you see Minneapolis.
I'd love to go and visit. I know. I'd love to go and visit up there with him one time, though. He's been playing that game Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
And he's been talking to me about like the riverbeds of like North Dakota pretty much nonstop for the past couple of weeks. So I'd like to go and see them.
I don't know if you're an outdoors person, but when I was there, I worked with a lot of guys from Colorado, of course, a few cats from Texas. which was the oil fields. I worked in the Gulf of Mexico cooking, and I also worked in North Dakota cooking for oil field workers. Oh yeah, I can make mean Cajun food.
Oh, that's awesome.
California.
Man. That's beautiful. But
so these guys would be like, hey, we're going fishing. I'm like, dude, and I never experienced, again, I'm from Cali blood.
Yeah.
Like it's the same pretty much year round. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna put a hoodie on in the winter and take that bitch off in the summer. Like that's all I'm wearing. I went out there, it was -45.
Oh my God. No.
And these cats were going fishing. I'm like, how the fuck do you fish in -45? Everything's frozen. They go, oh, we go ice fishing.
Dude, that is a sign from God that you should not be in that area at that time of year.
So ask your boy about ice fishing next time you talk. I'm like, do you ever do ice fishing?
I'll ask him.
Because that shit, it blew my mind. And these cats loved it. They're like, dude, that's how you catch all the fish. Because they have to come up. I was like, it still doesn't sound like a good time.
No, it does not. That's pretty funny.
Like, -45 is not the party.
No, absolutely not.
Are you? Now, I've been seeing you on Jacobin of late.
Yeah.
Doing your Jacobin minute. I don't know. What do they call it?
We're calling them quick takes.
Quick takes?
Yeah. Me and Ben Burgess are doing them. They're very fun, man. It's been a really nice opportunity.
I had Ben Burgess on the show, and I gave him a little bit of shit about the Jesse Lee Peterson thing.
Oh my God, that was so good.
That was like the funny. I had never heard of Jesse Lee Peterson until y'all.
They started coming after me and Michael, just like, you know, constantly reaching out and trying to get us to come on the show, which we both sort of realized that this was not it wasn't going to go anywhere. But you know, Ben has the patience for this stuff that I'm always amazed.
He kind of gives no fucks. Like he'll go up there, he's like, I wrote the book about the shit, so I'm see me.
He always says that he just can't stand the idea that any of us would be scared of these right wingers, which I respect.
it's not about feet. Like I was telling him, like there was nothing that he was gonna say to that dude other than you got one more beta male and I'm a come through this phone, slap the fire out of your ass. Like unless he was going to say that dude wasn't going to stop. And that's not his brand to say.
Yeah, no, of course. Did you see though, what's his, oh God, who's the pig? The white supremacist dude. I'm glad I can't remember his name, honestly.
Richard Spencer.
Yeah. Richard Spencer. Did you see he went on Jesse Lee Peterson's show?
To say what?
It's actually very funny. It's really funny because you know how Jesse Lee Peterson is just like ridiculous, you know, and it's like arguments don't make any sense. Jesse Lee Peterson was just like running laps around Richard Spencer, and he was
about being a racist.
You know how Richard Spencer does this whole thing where it's like, I don't hate anybody, I just think that my people are the best. Jesse Lee Peterson is just like, no, you either love black people or you hate them. And he just kept on saying that again over and over and over. And it's very funny to watch.
Because he'll make you ask that question, like, well, do you love black people? And, you know, I can see Richard Spencer being kind of fucked up by that because he's going to lose a lot of funding dollars.
No, he can't say that because he's a bigot and a monster.
No.
But anyways, that's the only, other than just watching him mess with Ben because it's funny. That's the only version of the show that I can watch.
And I told Ben, I was like, look, Ben, I've been black for 43 years and nobody I know knows who the fuck Jesse Lee Peterson is. And apparently that motherfucker's just down the road in L.A. Never heard of his chocolate ass before in my entire life. Yeah, and I still to this day, if I went up to right now down the street, I'm in Oakland, Chocolate City Part 5. If I go down the street, like, anybody know Jesse Lee Peterson? They'd be like, man, if you quit yelling that shit at me.
Yeah.
So that's what was even funnier. Like, I don't know anybody that knows him.
That's the thing about this world that is sort of difficult for me. And it was the hardest thing about me working with Michael. It's not Michael's fault, but it's just like knowing who these people are. I never knew who Dave Rubin was. I probably wouldn't have never known who Jordan Peterson was. You know, being in this world, you just like, you start fixating on these weird characters out there. And you do realize like, I mean, here's the thing. It does matter. Like, Jordan Peterson does matter because he reaches a decent amount of people.
Yes.
But the vast majority, but it's very easy for people in this world to overstate their influence because the vast majority of people have no idea who he is still.
And you know what's funny about that? So I did metal and punk music, you know, I do mm-hmm. for, and again, I'm not in a big band, so I'm always going to be in B markets, which are small towns. I'm always going to be the black guy in small town X in the middle of America. Mm. And there's a mentality that those guys have, the Jordan Petersons, the Ben Shapiros, even the Dave Rubens to a degree, that people will come at me and say some of this shit that sounds like it's right out of their mouth. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, you going to give me that Jordan Peterson bullshit? And they're like, who the fuck is that?
Yeah. That is interesting. Yeah.
And it's like, they're so simple.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they found a way, because I didn't know who Jordan Peterson was, even before I knew who, well, I guess I've been watching watched Michael Brooks on the Majority Report for a little bit, but I didn't really know who those cats were because Jordan Peterson just happened to show up on a YouTube feed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, watch him own this woman. And it was that BBC interview. And I watched it and I was like, okay, I don't know who this cat is. Let me see what it's about. And I was like, I don't really think he did anything.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, the Jordan Peterson, I mean, it's funny talking about him now, knowing sort of like the state that he's in.
He's all fucked up.
But
right?
Honestly, I still see people. From even like back home, like from even like some people I went to high school with in South Carolina or Texas, even I still see him every couple of weeks. Some person finds him. So even, you know, even with him completely like lobotomized somewhere out in the former Soviet Union, being fed steak by his daughter, who's now married to like an actual like Stalinist or an alleged Stalinist. His stuff is still reaching people, so you still have to engage with it a little bit. But I think that cloud has definitely passed. I don't know. I mean, like, look, I'm actually like, not to plug too much of my stuff, but like the Jackman video I'm working on right now is about like the self-help stuff. Cause it is actually like pretty insidious. Cause what Jordan Peterson is trying to do is to say to people, you feel bad about your life. The problem is that like, you're not cleaning your room and that you're challenging authority and questioning the system too much. Which is like a really dangerous piece of advice to give, man.
People. Like real talk. I'm gonna give you real talk. I was doing a little radio thing out here in San Francisco, and this dude was kind of echoing some Jordan Petersonisms when it came to Venezuela. This was a year or two ago, and it was kind of enraging me because I was like, "You don't even know anything about Venezuela. Like, you think Venezuela is this magical communist land, and you don't understand there's capitalism there."
Mm-hmm.
And he said something else that was like a Jordan Peterson quote. I can't remember what it was, about Marx, you know.
Oh, classic. Yeah.
Yeah. And the greatest thing Jordan Peterson ever said was, and I know Burgess talks about this a lot, was that whole thing about, oh, when these cats tell you that that's not real Marxism, that's not real Stalinism, it's their way of saying, well, I could do it better.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that, because a lot of the people that may sprout off, like we were saying earlier, can come off a certain kind of way.
Yeah. I mean, no,
dickish.
Well, that's definitely true. And also, like, look, I mean, I don't run away from like the reality of what happened there. You know, like I'm a big fan of Lenin. I'll just say that. But yeah, look, I think we can all recognize what happened in the Soviet Union, especially under Stalin, was a disaster. And that's, you know, honestly even like a small way to put it. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for us to be able to deal with that criticism, actually, and to think through it. And what's frustrating, what I see right now on the left more and more, is a complete refusal to actually even deal with the charge that is actually your tradition. Like, that's this is a little bit of a nuanced argument that sometimes gets me into trouble, but like, I actually, like, I consider that to be my tradition, as in a bad sense, and something that I have to like have an answer to and think about and question, like, why did a group of people who were trying to institute something that was supposed to alleviate suffering create so much suffering?
So much suffering, people,
yeah. Right? That's a challenge. That's a serious charge. Hell, we're trying to change the world. We should be able to think through complicated questions like that. But you get all these people who refuse to do it. They just, like, you know, they wipe it away. Because look, they did a lot in the Soviet Union too that was very beneficial. And you need to understand where the bad came from. Because I don't know, like, I think the Jordan Peterson stuff is obviously is bad faith criticism.
Yes.
But honestly, that's the closest thing to truth that I've ever heard from Jordan Peterson.
It's really simplistic and all that shit. And when I came at the guy with a more, and I was a little angry, nuanced critique of what he was trying to say, and just taking Venezuela as the argument, like, okay, let's, you know, we can talk about Stalinist Russia all you want to, but let's take something that's way more current, which is the Bolivarian Project.
Yeah.
You know, you want to talk about UBI? That motherfucker was instituting a UBI for housewives.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's what equality looks like. And so we're having this conversation, and I said something mean about Jordan Peterson. I was like, oh, you read that bullshit because you just want to fucking go clean your room. I said, you need somebody to tell you to clean your room. And he looked at me very seriously, and he goes, sometimes I need people to tell me to clean my room.
Oh, man.
And it fucked my head up.
Yeah, dude.
Because I wasn't ready for someone to be that honest.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, I don't want to overstate it, but that's definitely like, no, I mean, I'm telling you, that's like Adorno. Go back to Adorno. That's like, you know, the kind of like fascist mentality. Not necessarily accusing this person of being a fascist because they said they like to take orders, but like that kind of need is definitely like a dangerous part of society, you know, and that's why people like Jordan Peterson and hell, even Donald Trump, you know, can be successful because there is a part of the people who want that.
I watched that bullshit ass debate. I was doing a live stream with these cats called the Left Flank Vets. Mm-hmm. Nice. We were doing a live stream and watching it, and they definitely were all like, having a bit of a pity party about what Joe Biden didn't do. Mm-hmm. And I was like, look, dude, this is my take. And I know you got to go. We'll leave with this and I'll get your rebut. I was like, Joe Biden's job is not to get us. That's not their plan. We may not agree with it. That's just not the plan. Joe Biden had to be cognizant. Mm-hmm. He was, and he had to push back enough. Mm-hmm. And he did. And Donald Trump had a hissy fit. So all those cats that were not, quote unquote, not the racists that voted for Trump, that might have voted for Obama, saw the racists have a hissy fit 10 minutes in. Hunter Biden, Hunter Biden, Hunter Biden. That's Trump needs a crowd. Mm-hmm. It's WWE. I don't know. At this point, I was having a panic attack about him stealing the election because I had another cat on my show that was doing some... His name is Dr. Jack Rasmus. You should read his stuff. Some great October surprises about Trump stealing the election. And, you know, me and I both probably read about it ad nauseum. And I'm watching this dude at this debate. I'm like, I forgot you were saying some of the same shit in 2016, not because you wanted to win, but because you were trying to give yourself an out because it's never your fault. Mm-hmm. The USFL, we're football fans. Go back and watch. There's an ESPN documentary. What happened in the USFL? It's never his fault. His casinos, it's never his fault. His bankruptcies, it's never his fault. Corona, it's never his fault. He's giving you his out right now. Mm-hmm. Not my fault.
No, I mean, for sure. I mean, yeah, the debate was really just disappointing. I'm of the opinion that it's really not worth it to watch most of these at this point. I think that the people who are watching them are like, you know, are people who are really tuned in already and probably already have their minds made up. But I mean, I'll say this, like, I mean, it's getting difficult because I think we have to get rid of Donald Trump. I don't think that there's really any, you know, argument that Donald Trump continuing to be in power is in any way good for the left. I think the difficult thing is that some people are trying to make this argument that Joe Biden is somehow going to be better for the left. And that's the only thing that I've been trying to dissuade people of, right? It's like, you know, the kind of lesser evil argument that people are making. It's like, you got to stop thinking in that kind of mentality. Don't say things like you want to end kids in cages. You want to end all these things. You got to vote for Biden. It's like, because he's not going to end those systems. I'm just going to tell you, like, the only thing that's going to end those systems is like, you know, us doing the serious political work. Like Joe Biden might make the order, but it will be because of social movements that are making that happen, right? So people just need to get more responsible with that argument because it's starting to get a little obnoxious with this fake story that Biden's going to come in and you know have a change of heart for the person he's been his entire life. The fact that the last 20 minutes of the debate, and I said this, you know, on our stream on TMBS about it, was like, it's very scary to hear the legitimacy of an election being debated. But I don't think that Donald Trump actually has the ability to do it, to stop, you know, to be able to prevent, you know, to be able to basically mess with the results in a way that would maintain his power. And, you know, I think, you know, it's, I mean, it's a scary time. I'm not going to sit here and try to predict the future in its entirety. It's a horrifying moment that we're living in. There are very hard, you know, scary and serious white supremacist groups marching around. Donald Trump is certainly encouraging them. It's a terrifying situation. I just think, you know, it's important for us not to think that we're going to have cheap answers to a very complicated question. And, you know, the thing that's really such a nightmare is that, yeah, I don't think Biden has any interest in winning left-wing voters. I think, like, you know, so that was just me giving my, like, little speech to the left. And just, you know, briefly, I'll put on, like, my pundit hat if I were ever, God forbid, like, on a CNN or something like that. I will not do that. I promise you that. I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't.
You say that now. You say that today.
But, the thing is with Biden that is frightening to me is that it's going to be really hard to vote this time. Just like because if one, all the voter suppression that the GOP is doing and the fact that we're living through a massive pandemic, as long as Biden continues to be as uninspiring as he's been, look, I think most people can see that he's better than Trump. But you got to remember like what the actual act of voting is like taking time out of your day to go wait in line and do like a task. Mm. Right. And people think about it as like a decision. It's like, you know, for a lot of people, it's just like doing any chore. And sometimes it's easy not to do it. And that's the real difficulty with Biden, is that a lot of people are like not going to be, you know, are not going to feel that it's that important for them to show up for him because he hasn't really done very much to make, you know, him winning seem, you know, important enough or that he's competent enough for them to do it. So that's the bigger fear, I think, with Biden. Biden's not going to turn left and he's not going to court the left. And I just think that's a reality, too.
I don't think he's going to turn left. I do think I think Trump having the hissy fit is bigger than Biden being uninspiring. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. I think that crowdless hissy fit and that call to his brown shirts, if you will. There's a gentleman from your state of Texas. His name is Clyde Barrow. He was on my show. He's a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande. I don't even know if you know where that is.
No, I don't.
Yeah, exactly. It's down by like Brownsville.
It's a big river. Yeah.
But he wrote a book called The Dangerous Lumpen Proletariat, kind of comparing Trump to what Marx said about Napoleon III and his 18th Brumaire, about how he kind of rallied this lumpen proletariat to you know do this coup, and he feels that that's what Trump is going to do. And we had that interview a month ago, and that's literally what we see in that debate, you know.
I mean, look, I think there's definitely going to be some shenanigans following the election. I think that, you know, Trump is definitely going to whine. The only serious question then is like, is he going to have the social forces to enact what he wants to? And I don't think that he does. Sort of.
No, I agree with you.
But you got to be prepared for everything. I mean, look, that's not something to treat lightly.
They tried to come here. Those dudes tried to come here, the Proud Boys and at Oakland, and it didn't work out real well for them.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's why they go to places like Portland.
I think that's another thing too. Like again, Proud Boys, very serious and all that stuff is absolutely frightening and they're real and they're a threat. I also think it's important to put things in context too, that, you know, they're a scattered and smallish group that can still do a lot of harm and damage. But let's not, they want you to overestimate them. Because that makes them seem more powerful than they are.
Too. Oh, it was But I know you're busy. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Hey, man.
So this is David Griscom from the Michael Brooks Show and the Jacobin. Is it say Quick Takes?
Quick Takes. Yeah.
I'll put a link to both things up. Is there anything else? You'd like to plug?
No, that's perfect, man. Really, thank you so much. I'm really happy we were able to have this conversation finally.
Oh, I'm stoked about it, and be ready to get some funny Twitter messages Saturday.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
There's some music's going to play. Don't hang up.
Okay.